Deploying fiber could be easier because, well, getting the trench done might be less expensive, but you have less people to amortize the cost with, and it's in the end not necessarily the best way to do it. Wireless technology, while you need to have access to spectrum, so there's a regulation aspect to it, and that could be quite expensive in some countries. But once you put an antenna in place, you can provide access for quite a number of people. And depending on the technology, the radius might be smaller or larger, but you'll just have to put one antenna and not have to get fiber to every single person. So that's very attractive technology in places where there is no underlying infrastructure. One of the problems, though, is that who wants to see an antenna? I mean, in a city, it could be all ugly, but if you live in a suburb like where I live in, Washington, D.C., and in relatively nice suburbs, and nobody wants to see an antenna there. So you have, dealing with city regulation or city ordinance, but also dealing with neighborhood association who say, I don't want to see that, it's ugly. So that may or may not be the right solution there. So a combination of both technology are usually what people are doing to get the best of both worlds. So once you have this basic fiber or basic wireless infrastructure, you can start to connect people. But let's say that I want to have a connection between here and my office in Washington, and I want a fiber. Well, I'm not going to have a single fiber that goes from here all the way to Washington. That would be cost prohibitive just to put that one fiber for me, but B, there's no way I can get this done. I mean, it's just too long. So what we will do first is to share fibers between different parties. So, okay, here we go. On a point-to-point link on the fiber, we are sending light. But we don't have to send simply regular white light. We can send color light. So I can send green, red, blue. For example, what's your favorite color?
Red. Excuse me? Red.
Thank you. What's your favorite color?
Red.
Red.
Oh, that's interesting. What's your favorite color?
Green.
Green. Now, you see, we have a little bit of a problem, because if you speak green and you receive green, that's fine. If the two of you speak red, that's not going to work very well. You're going to step over each other. So you need to find maybe different shade of red. Maybe you will have a light red. Maybe you have a dark red. Okay? So it's a frequency. It's a lambda. So you change the frequency that you are sending the light through this fiber. And that way, the three of you could actually share the same fiber. So if you want to have more bandwidth, maybe what you need to do is to use different wavelength, different lambdas in the same fiber, and that if you have two of them, you have twice the bandwidth. If you have 10 of them, you have 10 times the bandwidth. So that's how we're going to do that, so that we can share this infrastructure so that people can put a fiber under the ground and not just one person, but many persons can use it. But still, this will be a point-to-point, for example, from here to this hotel to the center of Marrakesh. It's not going to go all the way to Washington. So what do we do? Well, we're going to use bits and pieces of fiber. Maybe there is a fiber that goes from the hotel to the center of Marrakesh. Maybe there's another fiber that goes from Marrakesh to Casablanca, and another that goes from Casablanca straight over the ocean to maybe New York, and then another one from New York to Washington, and from the center of Washington to my office. So there may be 5, 6, 7 pieces of fibers that we are going to interconnect point to point. So maybe we'll start using red as your color here, but doesn't mean that it will be red all the way. It has to be read in just that particular segment of a fiber. So when we go to the next segment, maybe it will be blue. And simply you need to map that particular wavelength to another wavelength. And same thing on the other side. So there are companies who run those fibers. And when they say we establish a fiber path from A to B, or from here, let's say, to my office in Washington, what they do is simply put point-to-point, all those different fibers together, and they find a wavelength that's available on each of those fibers, will not be the same all the time, and simply put a mapping in each of those different interconnect, and here we are. We can now send information from one point to the other point that will be far, far away. So what's the speed of all of this? Well, there's some standardized speed. The lowest you can get today will be about 1 gigabit per second on a fiber. What's typical for service provider today is to use 10 gigabit per second, and for the fastest link, you can go to 100 gigabit per second. In the data center, folks have been using 25 gig or 40 gig. And you will see some switches, for example, that may have on some side some 10 gig links and 40 gig on the uplink. You can have multiple of the above, because I was saying earlier, if you take multiple wavelengths, so let's say that you have a green wavelength for 10 gig and another red wavelength for 10 gig, you use them together, now you have 20 gig. The same thing with 100 gig, etc. So in the future, we may get faster, like 400 gig or 1 terabit is in labs somewhere, and some people have already running things like that. The faster we go, the more expensive it is. And the first year's things, I remember when we first had those 10 gig links, they were very, very expensive. And you want to have a line card in a router, it takes an entire slot, and it was more expensive than a car. Well, now it's like a regular port on a line card that has maybe 10, 20, or 40 of them. Cost went down very, very quickly. 100 gig is going to go through the same path. Still, right now, it's very few limited number of ports, but in the near future, it will be denser. All right, so now that I have those things, what I have is essentially a point-to-point network that goes from anywhere to anywhere. And fundamentally, this is the same as having a local area network. If I have two computers at the end of each point of a fiber, or a fiber path, that's the same as if I had a local Wi-Fi network and computers connected to it, which means that every node sees all the traffic. So let's say, for example, that you and I like to play games, and we are going to play some of those, Minecraft-type games. And Kathy, who is here, she's a very serious person, and she wants to send email, she wants to look at the database in the office. If we're on the same network, well, she will have a hard time to access the database because all the traffic will be used for our gaming, and that's not really good. So what we do is we segregate the traffic by creating different networks. So we say this is a virtual LAN, or this is going to be a subnet, a different terminology depending on technology we're going to use. Say this is our gaming network, and this is our professional network. What I'm trying to say here is we don't want to have all the computer in the world part of the same network. We want to isolate that for different reasons. So here it was an issue of bandwidth, but it could be an issue of security. Maybe she doesn't want her email to be vulnerable to attacks coming from other people who are doing something else. So sometimes it's a geographical reason. We want to say, okay, this is a network in the room here. There's another network in another room in the hotel, and we don't want them to be mixed traffic. So we are going to isolate them. So how do we do that? Well, we simply create a bunch of those layer 2 networks, and we interconnect them. And that's where this layer 3 technology, the internet protocol, comes to play. So we are going to isolate this and reconnect them at layer 3, meaning that there will be a router that has interface in a number of different local area network. And its job is to forward a packet from one network to another. And if you say the traffic stays into the branch of a network that's on the left, it's not going to say anything, to do anything. If it takes a packet and look at it and says, oh, this is actually for a network that is on my right-hand side, it's going to copy the packet and send it to the right-hand side. How does it know which network it belongs to, you look at the address. And that's why we have IP addresses. Yeah. And IP addresses are not intellectual property. This is internet protocol. Okay? And by simply looking at those IP addresses, we're going to say, yes, this is part of a network on the left or part of a network on the right or part of a network that is further out. And later on in this tutorial, we will see how we can interconnect all those routers together. So that's what we call layer-free networking. Once we have this infrastructure, now we can start to communicate. And the first thing we want to do is to have what we call a transport layer, or layer 4, that enables to have communication. So I want to talk to Katie. And I am either maybe in another room, so I'm going to turn my back to her to pretend that I'm in another room. Katie, hello.
Ack.
What just happened? I sent a message to her. She received that message. She heard me. And she's responding to me, ack, that says acknowledgement. So what do I know now? I know that she can hear me because she responded to me. She knows that she can hear me. But the one thing she doesn't know is if I can hear her. She just has sent something to me. So if I want to make sure that she knows I can hear her, I need to respond to her. And I'm going to say, ack. So this is a three-way communication, and we call this a three-way handshake. You may have heard in TCP called the three-way handshake. That's what we just did. So I'm going to do it again. So I'm turning my back. Hello, Kathy.
Ack.
Ack. Now she knows that I can hear her. And we have a communication established. Okay? Now we can send packets. So when we send information, we are going to chunk this information into bits and pieces. So we call those packets at different sizes. The typical maximum size is about 1,500 bytes. And this has to do with the Ethernet framing. There are ways to make it bigger, but most of the time that's what it is. Sometimes it can be smaller, but most of the time for large files, that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to chunk my file that I want to transfer to Kathy into packets of 1,500 bytes. So I'm going to send the first one. Kathy, this is my first packet.
Ack.
Now I know she has received my first packet. Okay? I'm going to send a second packet. Kathy, this is packet number 2.
Ack.
Great. Perfect. I'm going to send a third one. Kathy, this is packet number 3.
Ack.
Okay. Yeah, it's slow. Yeah, it still work. Send packet number 4.
Ack.
Yeah, slow. Maybe I need to send it a little bit slower. Kathy, this is packet number 5. Nothing. Oh, what happened? Maybe she's not awake? No. Maybe the network is down? No. I don't know what happened. Because I don't know what happened, I'm going to send it again. Kathy, this is packet number 5. Try again. Kathy, this is packet number 5.
Ack.
Oh, here it is. So now I know that she can still get my packet number 5, and I can go on to packet number 6, okay? But there have been what we call packet drops, like 3 packets that I sent to Kathy that never made it. So I'm going to think that this is not that she was asleep. No, it's that somewhere they were lost. And why were they lost? Yeah, it's very rare that packets are lost because the fiber is bad quality. That happened, but that's really rare. What really happened is that there were some routers in the middle, maybe those boxes in there, that were too busy. They had too much traffic to handle. They were congested. And when there's a congestion, what do? They drop packets so that they can handle the rest of the traffic. So that tells me that the bandwidth between me and Kathy is relatively small. It's not very good. So instead of sending a packet maybe every 1 second or 2 seconds, I'm going to wait. Get here is packet number 7.
Ack.
Good. I'm going to wait a little bit. Kathy, this is packet number 8.
Ack.
Perfect. Now if I slow down, the network is not congested as much, and all my packets go through. So instead of sending my packets as fast as I can, and having most of them dropped and having to retry again and retry again, I'm simply slowing down. And now maybe I can, after a little while, say, okay, maybe congestion is gone. I can start to go a little bit faster. And by either dropping the packets and sending me a signal that I need to slow down, or by saying immediately, yes, I can get those ACKs, the total bandwidth that I'm going to use is going to go up or down, and it will adapt to the circumstances. So that all the congestion control that the TCP protocol is doing. There is another protocol that is used on the internet. It's called UDP for User Data Protocol. User Datagram Protocol, sorry. It doesn't do any of these fancy things that we just enact here. It just sends data. And I have no idea if it works or not. So the application will have to have some kind of mechanism to decide if it's going to be received or not. Sometimes it doesn't matter. For example, if I send voice over IP traffic, in the middle of a sentence, if I lose some packets, I'm not going to retransmit it later, because instead of saying, hi, Kathy, how are you doing? She will hear, hi, doing, how are you, Kathy? That makes no sense for her. Absolutely no sense. So it's better for her to hear, hi, Kathy, doing. Where we have essentially a packet in order, but there might be mangled somewhere in between, and the connection is not a really good quality. So for those type of voice application, usually the UDP protocol is being used. Or when it's a simple packet exchange, like one packet in a response, where there's not a full communication happening, like for DNS in particular, so we say, asking a question, you give me an answer, then that might be just plenty. There's no need to get the overhead of this TCP protocol. So now I have a transport. I can send data to KFE and back. What can we do with that? Well, we're going to create a session. And this is not used all the time. It's mostly used for real-time communication, like voice or movie streaming or things like that. And essentially what this does is two things. First one is we can negotiate what type of traffic it is. And I can, for example, ask you, well, I want to see this movie, and what are the different formats this movie is available? And you can tell me, for example, it's available in this encoding or that other encoding at that quality, different level of quality. So we can negotiate that. And then the second part is some evolution of this TCP handshake that I showed you, where we can say we are going to send at fixed interval so that you will receive and it will look real time when you play it on the other side. So all of this is in the session protocol. Up next was what we call presentation. For example, when we were discussing about the movie catalog and I wanted to know what are the different formats. Years ago, it was some kind of a proprietary way of encoding this information. And then we moved to some kind of binary encoding, and then we went to XML, and now the latest version of that is JSON. So this is some kind of a human-readable way of encoding the information. In that case here, what we're talking about is a menu. So we have different items in the menu, so different value, different pop-up, and different functions that can be started when a user clicks on that particular item in the menu. So this is essentially a way to organize the information that we are going to send in a structured way. It's made in a human-readable format because at the end of the day, when you debug this thing, it's much easier than it is just a bunch of zero and ones. It doesn't work for everything, but for a lot of it, it really works well. It's quite popular now. But all of this is plumbing. Honestly, my kids don't care about that. My parents don't care about that. And if you have customers, they don't care about that. What they care about is the web. What they care about is sending email. Okay? This is the application. You have to do a good job, but you will be using protocol X or protocol Y. At the end of the day, it makes no difference. As long as For example, this kid can play Minecraft because that's what kids like those days, or watch a YouTube movie, or watch whatever they want. Okay? But so really one thing to keep in mind is all the technology underneath is just a toolbox. Okay? Customers are not interested in tools. They want an application. And the job is to make sure that this thing works. But to make this work, we have to make sure that the people who run the network can make some money. Because if they cannot make money, they're not going to run this very long. Okay? So earlier on, I was talking about you can share a fiber among different customers. So there are different business models that exist. For example, the simplest business model on the internet is you buy a lot of capacity and then you slice it into smaller chunks and you resell those smaller chunks. And you make a little bit of margin in each of those different chunks. So that's one business model. There are many other business models that exist. But at the end of the day, if your business model doesn't work, you're not going to stay in business very long, and all this is moot. And then there's another layer, which is the political layer, which deals with all the different regulations that you have to conform to. So different countries have different regulations. So if you do business in different countries, so you need to adapt to each of the different regulations. And there are also global issues like governance issues. For example, how do we agree on a protocol to do some things? For example, I was talking some of a JSON description. Now, do we agree that everybody's going to have some other same? So this is done in standard bodies. IETF is one of them, but as most of the stuff are related to the internet, there are others like W3Cs. And there are also ICANN meetings. You're on an ICANN meeting. That's what we're doing. Some internet governance on the domain names. So all of this is actually quite important. So that's why we, from seven layers from the ISO model, we went now to layer 0 to layer 9. Okay, now with all this background in mind, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into what is your name, what's an address, what's the route. So this whole thing started with a story that happens to me a while ago. I was traveling somewhere, I think it was in Ireland, and I had a really bad toothache, like really, really bad one. I just flew in, arrived in the country, I know nobody. Well, that's actually not true. I knew one person. I knew Kefi. Hi, Kefi.
Hi, Ellen.
You know, I have really a bad toothache here. I need to see a dentist. You have been here for a while now, and maybe you can recommend somebody to me. What's the name of your dentist? Dr. Jameson in Ireland. Okay. I know the name of his guy. Okay? Now I have to find him. Okay, so what's a name? A name is a word of a set of words by which a person, an animal, a place, or thing is known, addressed, or referred to. Example, my name is Alain. My name is Parson here. It could be a famous person. It could be a big race. It could be all kinds of different things. For example, if somebody gets really famous after he dies, sometimes they name a street about him. They name a university, a town, because this name was important. This name had a meaning. So if I know your name, I know who you are. So I'm going to ask you to remember three things in this tutorial. That's thing number one, okay? If I know your name, I know who you are. What is your name, sir?
Irfan. Irfan.
Irfan, now I know who you are. We can have a relationship. You know my name, I'm Alan. I know your name, Irfan. So we can relate to each other, okay? That's what is really important. I know who you are. We can use this name as a handle. And essentially, I can talk to Irfan directly, or I can talk to Kefi. Kefi, I just met this nice guy. His name is Irfan. Do you know him?
Yes.
What just happened here? We're not just communicating together with that name. I was communicating to somebody else about you, referring your name. So those are the two usages of names. So again, remind me, Kathy, what's the name of your dentist?
My dentist's name is Dr. Jameson.
Dr. Jameson. Thank you for reminding it to me because I'd forgotten. So she has just referred to me the name of Dr. Jameson. Now I can use this referral and try to go and see Mr. Jameson somewhere. Names have scopes. So I told you my name is Alan. Alain, if you speak French. In my family, I'm the only one, Alain. So it's a fairly common name, but I don't have any brothers or sisters, and my cousin don't have the same first name as me. So that was easy. When my uncle said, oh yeah, Alain should do that, or my father said, Alain should do this, okay, it was about me. Went to school. In elementary school, Alain was a rather common first name. I remember one day we were six Alain in the classroom. Okay? And we had a teacher. She was a little bit of a weird character. She would say, Alain, go to the whiteboard. And the six of us were looking at each other like, okay? Which one? Then she would get all pissed off and she would say, Alain, go to the whiteboard. And we couldn't say anything. We couldn't do anything. And then she said, oh, Alain drowned, go to the whiteboard. Okay, I knew it was me, right? So what does this mean is there are contexts where you need to really fully qualify the name. Like if you say Dr. Jameson, hopefully there are only one in the city where I am. If I like five of them, that may be more difficult. Maybe I have to know his first name. Maybe I have to know a little bit more about where he lives to find him. Okay? So on the internet, if I say that I have a machine that names is, www, well, there are lots of machines whose name is www. Okay? So I need to qualify by something, like the rest of the address, of the names, actually. So, now we have our scopes here. And that's interesting, but I still don't know where Dr. Jameson is. No idea. I'm in this new city for me. Never been there, first time. All right. So, I need to find the street address, which is a mapping from the namespace to an address space. Okay. How do I do that? Well, I have to go through some kind of directory. Kathy. I've been asking around, but nobody knows Mr. Jameson. So would you mind going to your Rolodex and give me the street address of Mr. Jameson?
His address is 125 Root Canal Road.
Thank you. Now I have an address, and I can go see Dr. Jameson. This process is called name resolution. So you will hear that a lot. The DNS, we do name resolutions. That's what it is. I take a name, and I get another information, which is the address, and now I can go and find this address. Okay? So, some recent issues about names. Well, by recent, I mean the last 10 years. Oh, by the way, all those slides will be made available, so you will find them easily. Issues about internationalizations. Well, there's different countries use different character sets. Chinese is different from Arabic, which is different from English, which is different from French, which is different from Icelandic. So that in European languages, most characters are about the same, except that, for example, my daughter's name is Anaïs. There are two dots on the I. And when she's in America, nobody understands that because there's on the keyboard, there's not a key with an I with two dots on it. So it gets confused, everybody gets confused. If she were Arabic or if she were Chinese, that would be even worse because those characters simply don't exist on the keyboard. So there are all kinds of issues with that. And there are some efforts that have been done to use Unicode or some other form of encoding to deal with internationalization. So it's a very complex topic And there are multiple places within ICANN and IETF where this is discussed. Another topic is authentication. I talked to Kathy and asked her what's the address of Dr. Jamieson, and I trust Kathy. That's okay. But if I were to ask somebody else, I may or may not trust that person. How do I know that that person has the right information? Okay? So if I were to ask you, what is the address of Dr. Jamieson, what would you tell me? Something, maybe not the same, you know? Maybe you are not in this city. Maybe you think about Dr. Jamieson that lives in New York, or that lives in Casablanca, or that lives wherever he is, okay? I want to make sure that I have a correct address. So we use cryptography to do that. And so this is called DNSSEC for Domain Name System Security Extension. This has been deployed now for a number of years. And again, there are a number of working groups in ICANN and IETF that are dealing with that. Expansion of the root zones, you have heard about all the GTLD programs is having different domain names or top-level domain names. Started with things like .com, .net, .edu, .org, and then a bunch of them have been added. Now there are quite a lot of them. So all of this is dealt with by a bunch of other working groups. I'm not going to go too deep into that. This is only, remember, an introduction-level class, not in-depth. All right, so 125 Root Canal Road. How do I go there? Or where is it on the map? All right, what's an address? Again, looking up in the dictionary, those are the particulars of a place where someone lives or an organization is situated. So the second thing I want you to remember from this tutorial. First one was, I know your name, I know who you are. Second one is, I know your address, I know where you are. Remember those gangster movies where they said, if you don't pay me back, be careful, I know where you live. Remember those movies? That's exactly what it is. I have your address, I know where you are. So, addresses have a structure. I don't live there, but many people want to live there, apparently. Every 4 years they change. This is the most famous place in Washington, D.C. The address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500-0003, USA. Okay, that's the address. If I want to send a letter or postcard there, that's the address. So if you look at this, there's some hierarchy. You have to read it from the end, from the right to the left. So the first important token is USA, that's United States of America, that's a country. Second is D.C. for District of Columbia. So District of Columbia is not a state in America. It is something special. But for a matter of post office, it's at a similar level. The District of Columbia has been separated into four quadrants. There's northwest, southwest, northeast, southeast. So this is in the northwest quadrant. This is the name of the street, Pennsylvania Avenue. And that's the number on the street, 1600. Not all addresses are geographically organized. So, for example, if you think about the telephone service, so I'm not sure it works here, but in America, we have those toll-free numbers, meaning that you can call and it doesn't cost anything. You have the receiver of a call is paying for it. They are all using the prefix area code 800. 1-800. So when I dial 1-800, I don't know if I'm going to talk to somebody who is in Washington, somebody who is in Dallas, Texas, somebody who is in San Francisco, or maybe somebody who is in India. There's no hierarchy by simply looking at the address that will tell me where that thing is. That's the same thing with IP addresses. If I look at an IP address, for example, 109.27.2.5, IPv4 address, simply by looking at the address, I have no way of knowing that this is an address here in Marrakesh. Now, there are people who have built a database to reverse engineer this, and you can do a lookup in that database, And they will tell you, yes, this is an address that is in this building in Hotel du Golf. Okay? But by simply looking at the address itself, you cannot do that. Similarly, addresses have scopes. So, if I talk to somebody in Washington and I say, oh, I'm going to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, but we know exactly what I mean. If I say to some of my friends, I want to go to Paris tonight, they may scratch their head because there's actually a Paris nearby Washington in Virginia. It's a very small village of 300 people. There are actually 29 cities in the U.S. whose name is Paris. Okay? And of course, there's the one in France. So similarly, that with names, you have to disambiguate when there is conflict. For an address, you may have also to disambiguate and to say, give more information so that we know exactly which Paris version we are talking about. Also, I can use the address as a handle. So I can use an address on a postcard, send a postcard. Or earlier on, Kathy was telling me she was going through a Rolodex and she was looking for the address of Dr. Jamieson. What was the address of Dr. Jamieson, Kathy?
125 Root Canal Road.
Thank you. My memory is really bad and I need to be remembered sometime. So that was the same story with names. You could use names to start a communication or use name as a referral. Addresses are the same thing. They have exactly the same properties. So now I need to go to this dentist as 125 Root Canal Road. Hopefully he doesn't have to do a root canal on my teeth because that's fairly painful. But now I have an address that's not enough. I know nothing about the city. So let's say, for example, that I wanted to send a postcard to the resident of the little White House in Washington, D.C., just to say hello. I'm going to write the address on the envelope on the right-hand side of a postcard, and the postcard will go there, right? Why does a postcard go there? Because there's an agreement between various post offices that will take my postcard and will send it to the right place. They will route it to the right place. So maybe somebody will pick up my postcard here at the hotel and bring it to Marrakesh, to the post office, central post office, and maybe they will put the postcard into a plane to Paris. And in Paris, somebody will look at this and say, oh, this has to go on another plane to New York, where there is the international sorting facility for mail, and then they will send it to Washington, and then eventually it will find its way to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The only reason why I can send a postcard anywhere in the world is that there's a cooperating system of different post offices around the world. This whole system works because of this collaboration between the post office. And when we're going to talk about the internet, this is going to be exactly the same thing. It only works because there is an informal cooperation between all the different parties. All right. Now let's look at a bit more in details about internet addresses, those IP addresses. So we have two protocols that exist on the internet today. Actually, there are more than that, but those are the two most common ones. There's IP version 4 and IP version 6. IP version 4 is the one that is most commonly used. An address is encoded into 32 bits. So bits could be 0 or 1. So you have 2 to the power of 32 combination. This is 4.9 billion. Actually, there are a number of them that are reserved for things like multicast, for things like service addresses, etc. And in the end, you have about 3.2, 3.5 billion addresses that are usable. There are more than 3 billion people on the planet. So there's a bit of a discrepancy here. So that's why about 20 years ago, we defined something called IP version 6. And instead of coding to 32 bits, we coded to 128 bits. And that is very, 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 very large number. I'm not going to ask any of you to read it. because I have absolutely no idea how you read this name, this number. This is too big. But this is not four times this, that's for sure. This is much, much, much bigger. The hope is that there will be enough addresses with that until my grandkids will have an opportunity to look at this. Okay? Now, you have heard about IPv4 exhaustion. As I mentioned earlier, we have more than 3 billion people on the planet, so there's just not enough addresses, right? So how do addresses get handled to people? Well, the pool of addresses is handled by IANA. It's part of the IANA functions. So you have all heard about IANA transition. That's one of the things that the IANA does, is allocate addresses to the regional internet registry. So there are 5 IRR for regional internet registries in the world. There is one in Africa that's called AFRINIC. There's one in Europe that's called RIPE. It's for Europe and Middle East. There is one in Asia Pacific, it's called APNIC. There's one in Latin America and Caribbean, it's called LACNIC. And one in North America that's called ARIN. So 5 of them. So they receive their addresses from IANA. Back in 2011, 2012, there was nothing left for IANA to allocate. So each of those registries have their own policies, and they have their own process to develop those policies. And at some point, they ran out also, and the only place where their address is left today is in AFRINIC. There's not that many left, but there's a few left. So the internet is still growing, so what's happening next? Well, remember this IPv6 thing? Large addresses. The whole idea was to deal with this problem. We ran out of V4 addresses. We all moved to IPv6. Life is good. The problem is IPv4 and IPv6 are not compatible. So the same as last week I was in New Zealand. That's the power supply for my laptop. That's the socket in the wall. Okay? Doesn't fit. IPv4 and IPv6 are the same thing. If I have IPv6 and you have IPv4, you can talk to each other. All right? So that's a technical limitation. So it's a technical thing. We can solve it with technology, and we can build a translator between IPv4 and IPv6, but that's still problematic. So we see a lot of uptake of IPv6, but we are not yet at the point where IPv6 is a replacement for IPv4. And we may be there in a number of years from now, but right now we are not there. So we can't use it. Why are we not there? Well, because not all equipment use IPv6. For example, I may have IPv6 going all the way to my house, but there's a TV there that is a smart TV that is downloading movies from Netflix or something like that. And that TV was built in a couple years ago, and doesn't understand anything about IPv6. So even though I may have IPv6 in my house, my TV, which is going to be the biggest consumer of bandwidth, will have to use IPv4. So from a service provider perspective, if you want to keep me as a customer and you only give me IPv6, I'm going to cancel my contract and go to somebody else because my TV is important. Actually, not to me. I don't watch TV. I don't have one in my house, but other people like TV. So the result of this is this V4 and V6 things are going to be there for a very, very, very long time until the day where you can go to an electronic store and by default everything has IPv6. Every single thing has IPv6. We will still need to carry IPv4. So, what do we do? There are 2 things that people are doing. The first one is their addresses that were allocated a while ago, but are not quote-unquote in use. And there are people who want those addresses. Oh, I can see a deal happening. So, that sentence here is wrong. It's not all 5, but 3 out of the 5 IR have IPv4 transfer policies in the books, which means that if I am a party who has addresses that I'm not using and you want to get my addresses, we can have a contract together. Maybe you will compensate me for the work I have to do to release those addresses. Some, might be some money exchange, but the registry don't want to know about that financial aspect. But you can go to the registry and I can go to them or write them a letter and I will tell them, please take my block and associate it to you. So there's a market for that. You're not buying addresses. Because addresses are numbers, so you cannot buy a number. What you buy is the right to register that number under your name. Okay? So it works because there's, as I mentioned with the post office, this collaboration about everybody that says, okay, we're going to believe that the system works. And if my block is registered under my name, everybody else is going to believe that it is really my block. If I transfer my block to you, and in the database it says it's yours, then everybody's going to believe it is yours. Okay? There's this trust that is really, really important. So different IRs have different policies. Some are more constrained than others. If you want to know more of the details, we can have an offline conversation about this. But in the end, to give you an idea, in the last 2 years, 2014, 2015, in the ARIN region, North America, there were about 38 million IP addresses that have been transferred like this. And the RIPE region was about 18 million. And in the APNIC region was about 10 million. That's a very sizable number. So there's a market that's functioning. Prices of those transfers, associated with transfers, again, you don't buy an IP address, you buy the right to register it. It varies depending on the size of the block you're transferring. So if you're transferring a very large block, each address is less expensive. There's kind of a discount for large volume. If you're transferring a small block, it could be a little bit more expensive. Typical prices that we have seen in very large blocks, about $5, $6, $7, $8. Small block, about $10, $12, $14, $16. Also remember one thing is that not addresses are somehow created equal, or maybe they were created equal, but some of them are now more equal than others, in the sense that, well, some of them may be in some blacklist, or they have been used by some people who have done some kinds of weird things with them, and you don't necessarily want those addresses. So if you're on the market to get some addresses, you have to do your due diligence to make sure that the block is clean. Now that you have those blocks, what can you do with it? Well, up till recently, a service provider, for example, will allocate one IP address per customer. And then there will be a small box called a NAT box, so that if you have five computers in the home, they can share the same IP addresses. Okay? Well, the same idea of NAT could be used to share an address among maybe 100 customers. So instead of having one address per customer, you need one address per 100 customers. So let's say that you have 10,000 customers. Instead of needing 10,000 addresses, now you only need 100 addresses. So if you were paying, let's say, $10 for an IP address, instead of having $10 per customer, now we are talking about 10 cents per customer. Different price point. So this combination of a market to transfer IP addresses and technologies to share those addresses is what really is keeping up this IPv4 stuff alive. And how long can this keep alive, be kept alive? Quite a long time. Okay, I'm not going to talk much about this. All right, so remember, I have a raging toothache here. I want to see this Dr. Jamieson, 125 Wood Canal Road. Is that correct, Kathy?
That's right.
Thank you. This time I remembered. How do I go there? Well, I need a route to go there. It's like if I want to drive from here to Casablanca, I need to go look at a map and find out to get there. All right? So what's a route? It's a noun. It's a way or a course taken to for getting from a starting point to a destination. Third thing I want you to remember, okay? I said three things. First one, I know your name, I know who you are. I know your address, I know where you live. I know your route, I know how to get there. Okay? One is who, second is where, third one is how. If you remember only those three things from my tutorial, I will call this a big success. Okay, I need to build a map of a network. So I've created this network here. This is my source. This is my destination. Okay? Remember I was telling you at the beginning of this tutorial, a router is going to take packets from one side and then forward the packet on another side, another interface. How does it do that? By looking at the IP address and looking up a map that says this IP address has to go to this destination or that destination. It's no different than you go to an intersection on a road and you see signs, Marrakech this way, Casablanca this way, Oran this way. Okay? How do we build this map? Well, we are going to build it from the destination back to the source. So, how does it work? Well, this is my destination. It's connected to a service provider here. So the service provider, at the beginning, is the only person that knows that this customer has this IP address. Okay? So he's going to announce to all his neighbor service provider, if you want to reach this guy, send me your traffic. Right? Now, those two guys who have a connection to the service provider hear this message. What are they going to do? Exactly the same thing. Resend this information to all their neighbors. Now I'm going to propagate it here, here, and here. This guy has received information from this router and also from this one. Okay? This path is 2 hops. This path is 1, 2, 3 hops. No reason to go to a 3-hop path. I'm simply going to go to the 2-hop path. I will drop this announcement here. Just keep this one. It's relatively simple. So what this is about? This is about, I know you. And this is about, I know a guy who knows him. And this guy is going to be, I know a guy who knows him. What you see here is essentially some kind of transitive trust. Remember what I said about the post office system? It only works because everybody collaborates. That's the same thing here. It works because all the service providers here collaborate with each other and somehow trust each other. Okay? If they don't trust each other, it doesn't work. That's one really, really important thing here. This whole system is based on collaboration. Now, when I'm going to send my traffic, I'm simply going to follow this in the other direction. Now, everybody knows about all those destinations, so I'm going to send the traffic. This router will say, oh, I remember. I know a guy who knows a guy who knows where the destination is. I'm going to simply send the traffic over there. There is no guarantee that the traffic will arrive. Remember, it's I know a guy who knows a guy, right? I'm not sure. There's no hack, as we said in the beginning, at each different step here, all right? All this will be done end-to-end using the TCP protocol. And any of those routers may drop a packet. In that case, we will reroute, or we will retransmit first. And it might be that the link here breaks, and then this router will decide, actually, I need to go around. Okay? That's how the internet will adapt to failures. Now, this collaborative process is really nice and well, but sometimes there are bad actors. What if somebody, bad guy here, shout really, really loud, hey, the destination is here, I know how to reach it. And he shouts essentially so loud that this guy will essentially believe him. Okay? Well, I'm going to send the traffic and I know nothing about all of this and it's going to go to the bad guy. We had an instance of that a number of years ago. I think it was an accident when somewhere in Pakistan they started to announce Google routes, you know? So how do we prevent that? Well, we're going to do the same type of things that I was explaining about DNSSEC. We are going to use cryptography to verify the announcements. The same way we use cryptography to make sure that when you look up in the DNS, in the directory, that the address is correct. We're going to use cryptography to authenticate the announcement. So there will be a system of public key, private key, and I can look up the public key of the destination, and I can see if the announcement has been signed by the private key or not. A bad guy doesn't know the private key, so he cannot sign it. So I'm going to simply drop all the announcements that are coming from the bad guy. At least that's the theory. This system is known as the RPKI, for Resource Public Key Infrastructure. It has been pushed by the different IRR. It is in use today, but there are some concerns that have been expressed. First one is more of a political concern. Are we talking about a centralized or are we talking about a decentralized system? Is there, in this public key infrastructure, is there a single route or are there multiple routes? If you remember my initial set of slides, I concluded with a political organizational slide, layer 9. That's where it is. That's why those concerns are important. Now, there's a technological concern also. This will guarantee that the origin of a route is correct. This will not guarantee that some guy in the middle will not mess around with it. So some people have expressed a concern that this is good, but not enough. So this is still work in progress. Okay, now I can follow this route that has been built by the routing protocols. The most famous one is called BGP, for Border Gateway Protocol. And I can send my packets, hop by hop, through all those routers, and arrive to Dr. Jameson that can take care of my tooth. I've now accomplished the goal that I wanted to, that I was set up for. And that is the end of my presentation. So if you have questions now.
If you have any questions, yes, please.
Any questions from the Jabba room? Oh, question in the back.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I think I will take advantages of it to teach my kids how to understand the internet. It's very easy and very simple. Thank you very much for that. Well, I think it's what is missing are the algorithm behind the routing. We didn't hear about anything about all the algorithms of the routing of the traffic.
So the algorithm that the routers are using. Here, the algorithm is this propagations of the announcement from the destination back to the source. And remember on this router here, I have received two announcements. One coming from this router, and one, a secondary announcement coming from this router. That's where the algorithm for the route selection comes to play. So I mentioned the simplest one, which is to say, here, two ops, this one, three ops. So the simplest algorithm is to say, I'm going to use a path with the shortest number of hops. Now, you can do something different if you like. You can associate cost to each of the links. For example, you could say that this link is very expensive. I'm going to give him a cost of, let's say, 100. This link is not expensive. That's a cost of 10. This is a cost of 10. This is a cost of 10. Okay? This path that has only two ops, total cost will be 10 plus 100, 110. This one will be 10 plus 10 plus 10 is 30. Now, I can decide that it's my policy. It's a routing policy at that point. I rather like to use the path that has the shortest cost instead of using the shortest path. So those are some of the algorithms that you can use to decide where to go. Or you can have other algorithms. For example, you could say, well, let's say that all this is in the same country and all those nodes are in a different country. you can say, I really want my traffic to stay in my country. I have a backup path that will go outside of the country, but I really like to stay in the country. So what you do is on all those routers, you put some filters that will say, when I receive this announcement, I'm going to prefer the one that are coming from routers that are in country, in my country. And you can vary that to suit whatever policy you want to put in place. Does this answer your question? Thank you. Another question? Yes.
I would like first to thank you about your excellent presentation and the way you present it. And is it possible to explain a little bit more the RPKI?
Okay. So RPKI. So you understand the way those announcements are made, right? Okay, so it's coming back from the destination, or start from the destination, I should say, and everybody is re-announcing this route. What could happen will be a bad guy here that will find a way to connect to another router in the path and send an announcement. And I was talking about the different metrics that you can add to a route. For example, the cost of a link, etc. So you can say, I have a really low-cost route to go to this destination. And that cost will be propagated by the other routers. Okay? So if all the routers use this cost metric, then we'll decide, oh, this is much cheaper to go there. Okay? So that's what we try to protect against. How do we do that? Well, every time the route will be announced, it will be announced associated with a certificate. Just like DNSSEC, there's a signature of the announcement. So the routers that send the message, I am the origin of this prefix, is going to use cryptography, use this private key, and will encrypt the announcement using this private key and attach this to the message. Okay? When the router here will receive the packet, what it will do is use the public key of the destination to decrypt the message, okay? And if it matches, then it's authenticated because the public key has been successfully decrypting the message. The bad guy doesn't know the private key, so he's going to put some kind of garbage in place of a signature. When the router here receives this packet, check the signature will not check because it doesn't have a good private key. So it will simply dump the announcement, drop it. So that way the bad guy can say, I have a very, very low cost route to the destination, but because it's not signed, it's not going to be accepted. Does it make it more clear? Thank you. Question in the back.
So I want to thank you for the presentation. I have a question concerning RPKI too. It's the same thing as like DNSSEC. It's the same thing we do in DNSSEC.
Thank you. It's the same idea. It's not exactly the same algorithm. It's not the same way you put it in practice. But that's exactly the same idea, okay? So the way it works is when you get your IP address block from your regional internet registry, then you will register there your private key. And they will give you a certificate that you could revoke later that you can use to put with your announcement, your route announcement. So if you are in Afrinic, when you go there, you register and you get what's called the ROA, where you have your certificate to sign your announcement. So it's a different model than DNSSEC, and because it's given to you by your IR, it does not necessarily rely on a single route. As in the DNS, because it's a global DNS, there's only one, there's one root. So there's DNSSEC from the root that goes down from there. In the case of IR, it doesn't have to. And that's what has created a lot of discussion. Would it be better to have one root for the system, or will it be better to have multiple routes for the system? And this is all the trust relationship between the different IRs and the different service provider that comes to play. Next question? In the back. Can we have a second microphone?
It's going to be my last question. Thank you.
Oh, you can have many questions.
We right now understood about routing and naming and stuffing. What about computing, in fact, inside the internet? Like the distributed computing, for example, how it's working. We know that Google has released its intelligent platform right now, where there's a lot of intelligence also and computing. How things are working inside? Thank you.
Thank you. That's a really good question, Matt. That will be the topic for a different tutorial because it's a fairly complex topic. All of this essentially says that I have a source and a destination. And the model associated with that for many, many years was what we call the client-server model. There's one server, there's one client, and you figure out the address of the server, you go talk to the server. That was back in the 1990s. What Google came up with is say, we're not going to put just one server here. We're going to put gazillions of servers. Cheaper server. And if one goes down, doesn't matter. Somebody else will pick up the slack and do the work. So the way initially it was deployed was simply just in front of a destination, there was what's called a load balancer. And what this is no more, no less than an ad box. And it's going to front-end, the communication will terminate there, and it's going to front-end maybe a farm of servers, could be hundreds, thousands of servers, and it simply monitor which ones are active, which ones are not, and there will be, in the simplest possible case, a round-robin algorithm to decide, let's send the traffic to this query to this guy, this query to that guy, that query to that guy. If the queries are independent, that's just fine. If the queries are dependent between each other, that's more complex. And that's where it will be a different tutorial about how people actually reconcile this thing. But the basic idea is when queries are independent, I can distribute them instead of concentrating them somewhere. So that was back in the mid-90s. Later on, people have realized, I don't necessarily need to put that thing there. I can put maybe a server there, because it's much closer to the source. So instead of having to send all my traffic all the way back to California, maybe I can have a local server here, maybe not right here, but maybe in Casablanca, or maybe in Spain, not too far. So the way it works is there are multiple ways of doing it. One of the ways of doing it is when you do this name resolution, remember when I asked Kathy, what is the address of Dr. Jameson?
125 Root Canal Road.
That's one answer. But she could say, I know that you are now in Marrakesh. I'm not going to send you to 125 Root Canal Road, but maybe I can send you in the Medina. And she can give me an address, a local address in the Medina instead. So this is called a geographic load balancing from the DNS. And if I have this, I can simply put some local servers in different places. If I can control the resolution of a DNS, I can look up the IP address of a person that does the resolution, meaning your IP address, and I can see, you're in Marrakesh. What is my list of servers? I have one in Casablanca, I have one in Madrid, one in Paris, and one in Washington. The one in Casablanca is probably the closest. So instead of giving you a generic answer, I'm going to give you a specific answer toward the server that is closer to you. There are other ways of doing that. And again, it will take another tutorial to go in details, but hopefully that gives you a preview of what the correct answer is. We still have a little bit of time for one more question. Going once.
Oh, we
Question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for this clear presentation and the interactive presentation. My question is about the new Internet of Objects. How can Internet can deal with this new concept in term of naming, routing, and addressing? How it can deal with the this large number of objects?
Thank you. That's a very good question. IoT, Internet of Things. There is a not too serious answer to your question and a more serious one. I will start that with a non too serious answer. Internet of Things is just the internet. Okay? The fact that this is a gizmo, that this is a fridge, that this is a cell phone, that this is a light bulb, it's an IP address, Okay? So there's nothing to change fundamentally in the architecture of the internet to deal with that. It's just something else, just like the cloud. When you say I have something in the cloud, well, it's on a server. It's not your server. That's what it is. But from an internet architecture, it's no different, right? Now, the second part that's a more serious answer to this is, and I think you hinted at this, is we are going to have like billions of those devices, right? So when I was saying we have already 3 billion, we have 3.2 billion PV4 addresses and more than that of human beings, we have like 6, 7 billion human beings. Now we're talking about maybe 100 billion devices. How are we going to do that? So there are two answers to this. The obvious answer will be to say, oh, it's IPv6. Okay? We have so many IPv6 addresses that we can give them to your fridge, to your light bulb and everything. Little problem that if you buy this gizmo, like light bulb that has IPv6, and you bring it to your house, and in your house you may or may not have IPv6 because your service provider may or may not have turned it on. If you have it, great. If you don't have it, you just bought an expensive paperweight. Okay? So the people who are building those devices know that. And it's a difficult proposition to put on the market today something that has only IPv6. So they will do it IPv4. So you could say, well, maybe they will do it both. But doing it both may be more expensive. They will have to put a little bit more memory, and then the cost of the device is supposed to be really, really low, goes up. So then we need to have more IPv4. Does it work? Well, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. If it's in the home, we can still use the NAT box in the home and do this. That's fine. And actually, most of the time, those gizmos don't necessarily talk directly to anybody in the internet. They talk through some kind of a relay. There's a box that is there to interconnect them. So that's somehow scaled better. But this is an interesting open question for the next few years. Are the people building those boxes going to say, let's adopt IPv6 en masse? Or are they going to say, no, stay on the fence, we stay with IPv4? I don't have an answer to this question. It could be both, or it could be either. It's a really good question. All right. One last question. Well, thank you very, very much for your attention today.
Everybody, we pass out a questionnaire. Please fill it out, and you can leave it on your seat, so you could hand them over to me. Thank you, Alan, for great talk again. 3:15, if you want to come back, or you feel free to stay here, we have David Conrad, our CTO, ICANN CTO, doing the next session on... domain name registry protocols. Again, that's at 3:15. Feel free to stay here, or you can come back and watch our CTO. Thank you.